It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. In today's conversation, we're going to be talking about the ways people can create solutions to all the different kinds of challenges that we potentially face. Creativity, it's essential to our future. How do we create a social impact that looks at the climate and helps us to be able to help communities at the front line? I want to know how we might be able to use technology in that to harmonize and create jobs and create a better future for all of us. With me today is Sharon McPherson, who's the CEO of Green Jobs Machine. Welcome, Sharon.
Thank you. Thank you. And it is the Green Jobs Machine, just to
look. The Green Jobs
Machine. You got it.
Yeah, we're like the Da Vinci Pursuit, and people
can do it off too. We're the ones. And it's an absolute pleasure to be here with you. So thanks.
Oh, this is wonderful. So I really want to start kind of this idea of a machine tied to green jobs, right? That sounds so intriguing to me, that you named it as a machine, right? So yeah. that kind of implies some things. So can you describe what the project's about?
Absolutely. So in describing what the project is about, if I might, let me just take a couple of steps back and give you some insights in terms of my background, because that will help you to understand how I came to the Green Jobs Machine.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, I grew up, I'm a reformed investment banker and Wall Street attorney. And for years, I've been working across around 14 markets in sub-Saharan Africa, looking at how we invest differently in frontline communities, but really investing in women and youth as my target area. I was asked to do some high-level foreign policy work here in the United States, looking at the intersection of climate and infrastructure. And so I've been part of this whole idea of how we build back better. And so as part of that policy work, I began to realize that a lot of the folks who create these policies had never actually created a green job. Can you imagine?
Like,
not
amazing.
What? It's this great policy framework. And it's like, how many green jobs have you actually created? Oh, none? Okay, well, let me tell you, it's not that easy to create a sustainable job, like
right,
one.
They're an expert at it, right?
They're an expert at it. So we've got a lot of those, right?
Yeah.
And and I'm casting no shade on the folks who do the really hard policy work, because you need policy, you need frameworks, you need legislation that makes sense, right? But I've been at the coalface of job creation in places, you know, on Earth that are really hard to penetrate, where people don't have hope, they don't have access to resources, they've had lots of politicians come in and make promises, and not a lot of delivery. And so that's where I've been, right? And so so that was one of the reasons why I was invited into this policy forum. So to make a long story short, you know, I began to work in the area of advancing technologies around probably about 12 or 13 years ago now. Was one of the first persons to graduate from Singularity University, which is based at the NASA Ames Research Center in Mountain View, and really went there looking for next generation water, energy, and food solutions for some of those hard to penetrate places where I've been working, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa. And had my mind blown, loved it, became a member of the faculty of Singularity University. And so that was my entree into really advancing technologies. And then I helped to bring them to South Africa, which is where I was based at the time, and then set up the Center for Disruptive Tech. So I teach finance at the University of Cape Town at the business school, and I had been running the Center for Disruptive Tech. So when I came to this question of how do you really make green jobs a reality in frontline communities here in the United States and elsewhere in the world, I immediately started drawing on this background that I've been telling you about, working with women and young people and infrastructure, which wasn't even a conversation, by the way, we were having in the United States, because we had infrastructure. We didn't need to talk about it. It doesn't matter that it was falling apart.
Right, exactly.
We had infrastructure, it's pretty old and it's falling apart, but we had it. So infrastructure really wasn't a conversation that we were having in the United States 15 years ago. But then as climate change has increasingly become an undeniable reality, entities like the U.S. Department of Defense, it's like, well, hang on for a second. There's national security implications for this. I mean, how are we gonna mobilize folks if our infrastructure doesn't work? And so I realized very early on in my work as a policy advisor that if we didn't leverage the capacity of advancing technologies to scale our efforts, particularly around how to make communities more resilient, then we were going to fail. And so by design, the Green Jobs Machine is a machine. We are looking at four playbooks. We're looking at how do you build community, first of all, because you got to start there. If you want collective climate action to work, you have to start with community. And we're failing to get community buy-in, which is why we don't have collective climate action. So no matter how much, you know, you recycle, et cetera, if we don't have collective climate action, it's not going to work. And so looking at how do you build community around this? How do you incubate those game-changing ideas that can come out of this creative capital that you're talking about, which is the subject of one of the things you're talking about here today? How do you then accelerate to make those ideas bankable, viable, so that we can scale? And then how do you use artificial intelligence and other kinds of advancing technologies to match the right resources with the right people? And so we're looking at a process that historically has been very high touch, and we want to tech enable as many of those playbooks that I've just mentioned, because that's the only way we can scale. Otherwise, we won't be able to. High touch alone won't work.
No, and you know, there's a fundamental thing that you started with in talking about in there, and that is that I think we are so used to the idea of focus groups. And, I have community input because I brought a bunch of people together and they listened to us and the experts talk.
Right.
Then that was their input. But but what you're in for, and I get it, is the long-term community conversations that need to happen before we even decide what the problem or solution is. I mean, from the outside, we can say, oh, we know what your problem is. That doesn't really wash. And until we come together and have those longer term, is what you're talking about. You're really talking about long-term conversations. And then secondly, you're talking about this tech part, which we'll explore further. But I just wanted to set you up for that because I know that's what you do and it's long-term work. And that's why we don't do it, because we want quick results here.
It's long-term work. We don't do it because we want quick results. And quite frankly, who pays for it? So exactly. Like, whoa, we're having a conversation about how to make our community more resilient. Where does that sit? I mean, is that in enterprise development? Is that in the social sustainability department? Exactly. It's just, so where does this sit? And so these questions and other questions that don't get answered is the reason why it's not happening. But if you want to make a community more resilient, and that's part of really our main thrust, adverse climate conditions are going to prevail. It doesn't matter. If we stopped all of our greenhouse gas emissions today,
we're still going to be having problems.
We're still going to have superstorms. We're going to have droughts. We're going to have, we're going to have all kinds of things happening that we're not prepared for. So that means that if those communities, particularly on the front line, I don't like to use this analogy, but I think it really works because people can understand very quickly and very clearly why this works. If we were fighting a war and you didn't hold your front line, you got a problem. So frontline communities are those communities that bear the first and the worst of adverse climate conditions. So let's take one of our strategic pilots is in a place called Luling, Texas. That's in Caldwell County. That is the cattle ranching capital of America.
Right.
Okay. So these are not folks who want to, you know, you don't go in there waving your climate mitigation flag. These are farmers. These are cattle ranchers. These are fourth, fifth, sixth generation, 10 generation people who've been at it. Cattle ranching is part of what they do.
Right.
It's part of who they are. So if you want to talk to these people about what they can do to make their activities more sustainable, you better have a good story. And so the way that we were able to start to have the kind of conversations that you're talking about in the heart of cattle ranching country in America was to talk about resilience. Because, you know, the big freeze came along and livestock
died. No.
Crops died. People didn't have access to the internet. They didn't have access to energy, electricity, right? And so these were people who were hard hit and they were hurting. And so we can go into a community like that and say, let's start a conversation about how we're going to invest differently in this community to make it more resilient. Some of you may not buy into the idea that climate change is a real thing. We don't need you to.
No.
But you are interested in making your community more resilient. How many cattle ranchers are interested in making their community more resilient? 100% of the people raise their hand and say, we are. And so one of the great things about the Green Jobs Machine and our approach is that you can be a climate denier and still be on board. We are tech agnostic. It's about understanding where the community is first and how can we serve and crowd in all of the global expertise and the resources that are needed to make your community stronger. Now, everyone is interested in that conversation.
Yes, and a couple of key words that you talked about in there, and that was one, is that we're coming and we're listening to you, right? Two, I mean, and it doesn't matter, we're not telling you something, we're listening to you.
Yep.
You went through a really hard time. That was obvious. We know all together, we know what was there. And then the second thing that you just said that was so, I think, revealing was the idea that resilience is at the heart of stuff. And in the United States particularly, I think we built it on resistance. So everything was that we made systems, including our technology systems, if were resistant to the threat at the time. I was thinking of the internet. It was built to be resistant to a Soviet threat, but it wasn't resilient, meaning that if somebody figured out another way to play with it, like flooding servers with too many messages and others, it can bring it to its knees. And so it wasn't resilient. It wasn't able to get past the threat that we thought at the time we designed it. And so you're right. I mean, with the ranchers, you're talking about something that they had learned to resist, to build systems that resisted, and yet the climate didn't allow for that. So their resistance to it, their systems failed them. And so now you've got them going, oh yeah, I agree with you. The resilience is what I want. I want to figure it out, but I don't know how.
But we don't know how. So a couple of things that you said that are spot on. Resilience versus resistance, I think, is really, really an interesting juxtaposition. And you mentioned the internet and how, a lot of the science and the technology that we use, whether we like the military or not, it actually comes from military science. So the idea of resilience is actually based in military science. Mm-hmm. So between the two world wars, the U.S. Army War College was tasked with understanding how do you militarize over 15 million people? Because as you recall, we were not interested in participating in World War II, right? You know, Pearl Harbor changed some things for us, but we still needed to understand, even though we were practicing a policy of isolationism. I know, so it seems like a little bit familiar, right?
A little familiar right now. Yeah.
Right. But we had a plan, and that plan was, should we be called to participate, we needed to be able to quickly militarize people and demilitarize people. Now, why am I talking about that? I'm talking about that because resilience as a technology, resilience is a thing. And it's not some fucking funny thing. It's a real thing. And it's a core tenet of U.S. national security policy, right, by the way. So if you look at the Department of Defense's strategy for dealing with climate, resilience is a major tenet of that strategy. And resilience training, which is part of what we want to do in communities, is actually based in military science. How do you galvanize people across race, across age, across gender, sex, et cetera, language? Military is very good at doing that, right?
Yeah, and so logistics.
Absolutely. So we are actually anchoring some of the technology that we're bringing, not just to listening, how we listen. So we're using social media and mobile telephony and other things to actually track how are we listening. So I mean deep listening, not just having that long-term conversation, but using technology to understand, like putting up heat maps. Where are we winning in this conversation in terms of people actually understanding what is resilience, the resilience plan, the resilience strategy, how's it being implemented? So leveraging the capacity of technology to help us to communicate more effectively, which means that we've got to be able to listen, and we need to listen deeply, and we need to listen to understand. So we're going to be using technology to help us to understand that, as well as finding the leanest path to the solution. So once the community has said, we buy in, here's our resilience plan, we're all about it, we want to roll this thing out, what are the capabilities that we have? What's missing? What do we need to make this a reality? We're not doing that. So we've got resilience indexes that exist today, but no one's leveraging technology to enable this process in a way that we can figure out how it works in Luling County, in Caldwell County, in Luling, Texas. And then we take that to Louisiana.
Yeah.
Right? And then we go to Florida. Yeah. So Miami can learn some stuff. How did it work there? And what do we do? Because New York needs some of that too. I don't know if you just saw that in the New York Times. They're going to be investing billions in terms of their own resilience strategy down in South Street Seaport area and some other areas where, you know, New York City planners are very concerned about the impact of climate change on the city.
You know, and particularly, I think, you know, I would argue sometimes I think it was by design, but some of our poorest communities were left out of that technology loop. And so there's a whole lot of things that still leave people out. So being poor or being in a community that's rural, for instance, like you were talking ranchers, you know, access to high-speed internet, to data, to information, to do better, just doesn't exist, or it's hard to find. And so what you're talking about is really important. I also like what you were talking about. I think we forget that it takes money to do this, and the military has an undue amount of money. That really helps for them. They're not just building, you know, planes and war machines, but they really are investing in some future looks, and they're collecting data that no one else is collecting because they have the research money to do that. And so I think that's a really good insight that you're talking about, is how do we bring that to it? But you also were talking about deep listening, and so we're back and forth. So I'm curious about how does creativity fit into there? And I think that must be at the human element. So you're enabling them with this technology, but how do people become resilient with their creativity?
Mm-hmm. Love that. Our theory of change is based on the idea that resilient people form resilient communities.
Great.
You can have as much technology and plans as you want, but if the people have not bought in and they haven't brought to the conversation the most powerful machine on the planet, which is still the one between our two ears, then it's going nowhere. And that's part of the problem that we're addressing. There's all kinds of frameworks. They're so complex. They're not easy. They're not fun. I mean, what if you made this interesting for people? What if you gamified it? What if you made it fun? And we can talk about how we're leveraging technology to do that. But I want to take you back to something else that you said, Mark, about the military and the capacity to aggregate data and to understand and to make sense of things. And you look at those frontline communities. I'm from Virginia Beach, Virginia. I grew up with nuclear submarines in my backyard. One of the largest naval amphibious bases in the world, Little Creek, is where I grew up in that area. And those are actually frontline communities, many of them. They are marginal. You don't put big infrastructure projects in rich communities. They're always in poor communities because the poor people can't say, not in my backyard.
Yeah, I don't want that welding in my backyard or that metal.
Right, the rich folks can say, we don't want the stuff in our backyard. Get it out of here. Yeah, and then off it goes down the road. And so it's kind of, I don't know what the right word is to say, but I think it's interesting to say the least that we've got to go back to those very communities because they're the vanguards. And if they fail, dire consequences for all of us, right? And so if you look at the communities around most of the naval installations or military installations globally, they're marginalized. There's a train track running through the middle of it, right? Yeah. And those are the very communities that we've got to shore up because otherwise we're in big trouble, right? So frontline communities are almost always marginalized communities where investment hasn't flown. The banks have been redlining. People are poor. They can't say in my backyard. And so I think it's not just the right thing to do, but it's the smart thing to do for us to now go back and look at how we invest differently in those communities. But truth be told, every community is going to need to have a resilience plan. We're starting with frontline communities because we've got to shore up the vanguard.
Well, it's an interesting thing you bring up because I was just thinking about the Bay Area in San Francisco. And thinking about how people weren't in very wealthy areas, weren't thinking about the backbone of how that town or community functions. And so they allowed housing and pricing to get so far out that no one could live there. And people might have to commute 3 hours, which they aren't going to do. And so what you end up doing is your whole community is no longer resilient. It's collapsing because you don't have the workforce to be there. And yet in their mind, they thought, well, we're so superior, we can buy whatever we want. Well, you can't buy people who are essential to the resilience that you're talking about. And they're trying to go back and re-engineer that. And that's really difficult because there's still this thought, and that's what you're saying. There's still this thought, not in my backyard, I don't need it, I can buy it. Well, no, you can't.
No, you can't.
You're not going to buy out of climate change. There's no way out of it.
That's absolutely right. Look at Miami. So you have Little Havana up on the hill, right? Or Little Haiti up on the hill. All the cool, fancy stuff is happening down the hill.
Right.
And now, you know, with the sea levels rising, everybody wants to run up the hill
and buy those,
you know, and take over those neighborhoods and absolutely. Those poor people. We don't know where they're going, but what's the point? I think we're agree. The point is that, listen, we need to be thinking about what we're going to do. Those of us who are living down the hill, because not everyone's going to be able to run up the hill. Right.
That's right. So
we need to be thinking and planning. And because the average person just isn't thinking about this, they think, oh, the city planners, they've got it all sorted out and we're just relying on folks. And so part of our mission as the Green Jobs Machine is to help people to figure out what is resilience, why it matters to me, and then to give the average person in a community the capacity to do something about it. And so that's why we're going to be rolling out these grand green challenges to say, hey, Mark, you are living out there on the Cape. You've got a great life, a great lifestyle, but you're switched on. You understand that climate change is a real thing. What do you think? What are your ideas? Get with your neighbors, talk about this. Let's set up a green grand challenge. We want you all ideating around how you see your community in the future and what are some of the cool things that we could start to do today that could make a difference in your own backyard.
Yeah, and what I know about the community development work I've done in the past when I was in Indianapolis was this that what's really important are there's so many planning efforts that communities have gone through. In fact, we tried to assess all of those with a project we were doing about waterways. And we pulled together every plan over the last 20 years, and it's ridiculous. Every agency plans, every, you know, the library, the banks, everybody does. And what happens is all those get shelved and they all say, oh, we're happy with it, but nothing's been done on the ground. And so I guess my question to you is, how do you, through the green machine, see making little wins so that people get confidence, not waiting for the big, big thing, but how do you get little wins to give confidence to people that you're more than another plan that's just coming in?
I love that. I love that question, because that's really, now we're really getting into like the meat of the thing. Because what we don't need is just another plan that ends up in someone's desk drawer and is never implemented. We've got enough of those. There are tons of resilience planning frameworks out there in the world.
Absolutely.
No one uses them because they're so complex, they're difficult. And then once you've done the plan, how the heck are you going to implement the thing?
Right, and we're all happy.
It's a great plan. And then whoop, into the drawer goes, never to see the light of day again, right? So clearly we don't need another plan. And so that's why we're not really leading with, oh, we're going to come into your town and do another resilience plan. We're going to be aggregating data around how do you get people to actually do the stuff. Yes, the planning has to be part of it. And so that's where our gaming theory and our behavior tech comes in. And so that's one of the reasons why we are the green jobs machine, right? And so our community building playbook is infused with behavior tech. We've got neuroscientists, philosophers, all kinds of cool technologists who help us figure out how do you actually engage with people. So that's why I said our listening is not just us having a conversation. Our listening is really deep listening, leveraging all kinds of technology that is available today. See, Mark, before the technology wasn't really up to the task. But today we've got the capacity to understand how people are engaging in a community. What's the scaling technology that exists to make this plan a reality? Where are the sticking points? Like, we've just had a conversation with 100 people with a dumb phone, doesn't even have to be an Android. I mean, it doesn't even have to be a smartphone, just be a dumb phone. With a dumb phone and the internet, we can actually determine who's really engaged with this. How do we overcome the limiting beliefs, ideas, attitudes, and assumptions that individuals in communities have about their own community?
Yeah,
oh, we've had a million plans. They never work. Why haven't they worked? And how do we overcome those? That's the secret sauce of the green jobs machine. The fact that we are partnering with some of the best behavior tech specialists on the planet to help us to overcome that inertia, right? That, oh, we've been there, done that, seen it. Let's move on. Overcoming that to actually get people engaged in the process and then crowding in the resources that are needed to take these ideas across the finish line is really what we're all about.
Yeah, and that's real genius. I'm talking with Sharon McPherson about creativity, social impact, job creation, and climate change all in one quick session here, and we'll be right back.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today I'm having a conversation with Sharon McPherson, who is formerly with the Center for Disruptive Tech Partners in Cape Town, South Africa. She uses digital informational strategies to upskill and reskill individuals in the workplace. And before we went to the break, we early on in our conversation had to talk about resistance versus resilience. But there's a particular area that you really hone in on, and that is on how does capital move, right? Sure. In that, and then how do we reinvest in communities? Because what we know is the two sides are sometimes it's that we aren't a part of the plan that gets developed. I mean, of implementing it. That's right. Implemented on us or for us, or, you know, we're there to help, which is always a big problem for me, that word help. We're there to help rather than to support. It's a different thing. And then you go to the other side too. And that is, well, once we are ready and we're ready to go,
right,
where's the money, right? I mean, in the end, that's how it works for any business or anybody that's wealthy. So where's the money to do this? So you've got some ideas.
Yeah. And so we're taking a blended finance approach to how to solve for the lack of capital investment. Like I said, we're starting with frontline communities, but our activities aren't limited to frontline communities. Quite often wealthy communities, you know, have budget for these kinds of things, but not always in terms of some of the cool ideas that you, Mark, may have. Right? I mean, you're an individual in your community and you might say, hey, listen, I live out here. I live right on the beach. Here's some things that are happening. Here's some things I see. Here's my idea. I think it can generate renewable energy. It can solve for rising sea levels. And I want to, at some point, maybe patent this idea. What do you say? I want to help my community, but I also want to
do that. Yeah,
I want to do something cool. I want to take my ideas all over the world. Can you help me with that? Absolutely. And so that's not an idea that you're necessarily going to take down to your local enterprise development department and get funded. But in many communities, there are what we call scaling infrastructure. Maybe there's a university that has an incubator. You know, there could be accelerators and things that are working in communities, but in lots of frontline communities, there aren't. And historically, there hasn't been investment in certain communities. And those are generally the communities that are most vulnerable to adverse climate change, precisely because those are the places where you put the infrastructure. So you put the waste incineration plant in the community that can say, not in my backyard. So what does that mean? So let's use Baltimore for it as an example, right? Right down the street from the nation's capital, where I'm coming to you from, right? So you look at the incidences of asthma in those communities and other kinds of ailments. So these are people who are battling literally physical ailments because they live in close proximity to, let's say, a waste incineration plant. There's other kinds of interesting things that are happening in Baltimore as well. But if you look at historically how investment has flowed in those communities, it hasn't. And why is that? Because if we take financial capital, capital flows to where it already is. Like, money likes to hang out with its friends, right?
Right.
Right. And so if you take a community and you take a railroad track and you put it right down the middle, and side A is the good side, where, you know, the banks are happy to not just take your money, but they also make loans and make working capital loans to the businesses in those communities, right? You know, the bankers live there. And so they're happy to lend money to you, Mark, to go out and build that, you know, next golf course or whatever it is that you're interested in. So capital is flowing there. People do business with people that they know and they trust. And so I know you, you're my neighbor. I'm going to do business with you. That's side A of the railroad track. No problem accessing capital there, and everything works. The tax base is fine. The schools are fine. Everything's working. Now let's go to the other side of the railroad track. Let's go to community B, where the waste incineration plant is, where people don't have access to healthcare. They're sick. They have, you know, lower income levels. They have, and generally don't have access to tertiary education, other kinds of things, other kinds of challenges. Capital doesn't flow to those communities, right? And so if I am Mark, and I've got the same cool game-changing idea, but I live in community B, who's gonna fund that idea? And so what we're saying as the Green Jobs Machine is, if you look at the ecosystem of innovation and creativity, there is a huge percentage of the population that doesn't have access to that ecosystem. Right. You go walking around Silicon Valley and you don't see a lot of people, Mark, who look like me. Well, guess what? My ideas have impacted the lives of millions of people. I've created thousands of jobs with my intellectual capital. And I'm just getting started. And there are lots of incredibly creative people who are in proximity to the challenges that they face, who have absolutely incredible ideas about how to solve those challenges. In fact, we think that the people who are in proximity to the challenges are best at ideating around how to solve them. And if you partner with those people and you turn the spotlight on and then you crowd in resources to say, let's help you overcome those personal things so that you can transform and transform others. But then we're going to also take you on a journey and we're going to crowd in some capital and some other kinds of capital, human, creative capital to help you take this to another level. That just makes sense to us. It's an ecosystem approach to investing differently in people who are super smart and super capable.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, all my life has been in either museum or classroom education as a part of what I did before I started, you know, a museum without walls. And was this idea that in our schools, look at it, we want creativity to bubble up. We say we're going to invest in our schools. But you go into a school in most major urban settings, and you can find the public school runs out of paper and pencils after the first month. And I'm going, how? And it's only by the underpaid teachers that sometimes that gets overridden. But you're talking about the same thing in our community that I see in a classroom. And that is, if you don't have the paper and pencils to be creative, if you don't have something to draw on or with, what is this? I mean, we are disabling the ability of people. And no wonder it becomes for people, I don't know how I can, I don't even have the tools to begin. And so you're talking about bringing the tools to people as well that allow us to be creative, because I can have a wonderful idea, but if I can't communicate it to anybody, it's not going to happen. And if I can't get if I can't get the capital, it's not going to happen too, which is true.
That's right. And so on a very real level, Mark, we are solving for a capital deployment issue. Yeah. I firmly believe today, right now, that the way that we have managed capital deployment, in fact, it's been underinvestment by design, but we can talk about why I'm saying that. But right. I firmly believe that the methodologies and approaches to how we create new businesses that can help us to address climate change, those approaches have not worked in marginalized communities. And I do not think that you can take the same capital approach that caused the marginalization in the first place, and then you're gonna deploy that very same capital approach to fixing the problem that capital approach created. I think it was Einstein who said the same thinking that created the problem can't be used to solve it.
Yeah, and you know, I see it at the level of, you know, as a nonprofit organization, I see it at that level when I'm working with donors and foundations, and we need their support, but it's gotten harder because there's this thing that happens among foundations, but also among wealthy people sometimes, which is called donor fatigue, which is, I don't want to stay in there past 2 or 3 years. I just want to do a little something. And that means that capital is not enough long-term investment. We'll go build, you've been in there. We'll go build a hospital somewhere. And we'll get it up and running. We'll have all the state-of-the-art machines and all the training. And then after about 10 years, we go, okay, I'm done with that. You should be able to sustain yourself. Well, we haven't built a resilient, sustainable capital system for that. So then when the machines break, how do I pay for that? When the hospital needs, you know, to have a new roof, how do I pay for it? You know, it's, I don't want to pay, you know, and that's another thing. We have a lot of our donors. I don't want to pay for any ongoing expenses or any operations. What I want to pay for is the thing, right? You know, build a building, build a pump, build, you know, and we've got to change that narrative, because that is the very narrative that you're talking about that has led us to the trap that we're in, because there isn't a way for a small nonprofit or a small community organization to say, what are you going to do after my money's gone? That it doesn't exist. Somebody gave you $40,000, you aren't going to just make up $40,000 on your own. And so it takes continual investment in a different I think the model's broken. Exactly what you're saying. Yeah. It is what marginalizes us.
Yeah.
Very well-intentioned people.
Very
and organizations, and I'm not dinging any of them, but unless we have new models for how we move capital, I don't think, I think the model of you having to apply and you have to be pretty savvy to apply and get a grant, you know, I think it's just not going to work for us.
No, and I would agree with you. We call ourselves adventure capitalist. Yeah, we're adventure capitalists, and we love that too. And it opens up room for us to be able to continue to ideate and create new approaches, which we hope really will be transformative in terms of people saying, "Wow, I mean, you know, these guys, Y Combinator doesn't have anything on these guys. These guys are going in and they're transforming communities and they're generating a 300% return on investment," because we've locked ourselves into this market-based consideration of all things, including what a human life is worth. And that's dangerous, because our market-based approach to determining the viability of any investment opportunity means that we don't take into consideration things like resilience. We don't take into consideration things like, are we going to actually have a city in 15 years? I mean, we're busy worrying about all this other stuff, but we're not taking into consideration the medium and the longer terms impact of our activity. Otherwise, we would just shut down all the coal burning plants like right now today. But we can't, because we've got a market-based approach that's got us hooked on CO2, right? And so as a result of it, well-meaning people find themselves trapped in a paradox. And I think when it comes back to your point around nonprofit versus for-profit, I think markets, it's a false paradox. And so the Green Jobs Machine is organized as an LLC, but we have baked the social impact metrics right into our operating agreement. So we're legally binding ourselves to be about the people and to generate a market-related return on investment, because we can't get away from that, right?
Right.
We can't get away from that. And so, you know, I would just encourage the listeners to challenge the paradigm, to challenge the thinking around nonprofit versus profit, because the same way that we created a nonprofit, it's a juridical person. It exists. It's a thing that, you know, we created, and we made some statutes, we made some laws, and we said, if you do this, we're going to give you a tax break, and these are the rules, et cetera, et cetera. The same way that we created those rules, we can create other rules, right?
Right.
Right. Yeah. So
we can have new ways of thinking about it.
We can have new ways of thinking about it, as opposed to this, are you a nonprofit or for profit? It's like, how about if we're both? How about if we like really are going to go out and we're going to impact and we're going to change the world and we're actually going to make money too? Like, why is that a bad thing? Like, why can't we have our cake and eat it too? Isn't that what cake is actually for?
Yeah.
Right.
Right. I mean, we get something, right? We get delicious cake.
This is cake. And we like eating cake, and we like sharing cake, and we like baking cakes. I mean, like, who told us we couldn't?
You know, what you're talking about is absolutely at the heart of it. It's really that, how do we change those avenues and pathways across the board, whether we're nonprofit or not, or for profit? How do we rethink what investment is? And what you're talking about is also, how do we rethink it for long term? That doesn't, no one moves anything, moves a company or anything. Think of what we subsidize.
Right.
And well, whole industries like the coal industry. We subsidize as a federal government, right? Because they honestly can't make it on their own. And so within the system, we say, oh yeah, there's a few people that make a lot of profit out of it. Sure. But again, the common everyday worker or the other. So the money doesn't flow. That idea that Reagan used to have, that trickle down, it's just not there. It does not make it past a certain point.
No, it doesn't. And you know, when you start talking about kind of macroeconomic theory, it takes me back to Keynes. And you know, one of the things that Keynes argued was that you know, he thought that we would reach this point of abundance and that we would like, everyone would have enough. And then we would be like, okay, well, cool. So now let's look at some new economic theories because, you know, this one's played out. We got it. And then that just never happened. We've blown past that place, right? And we still don't have enough, but we are, I would surmise that every person who's listening is so much wealthier than your distant ancestors could ever have imagined. You've got more stuff. You know, you're walking around with a supercomputer in your pocket and you can do stuff and you can go places. And we are so much wealthier than our ancestors could ever have dreamed of. But is it enough? And quite frankly, we've moved beyond that place where we're consuming more than our planet is able to sustain. So I think we're going to have to come back to a place of solving for the tragedy of the commons, right? Because that whole theory, Keynesian economics, and so much of what underpins our macroeconomic theory today is based on this idea of scarcity. But we know that if the resources of our planet were distributed evenly, every man, woman, and child on planet Earth today would be a millionaire.
Right. And if we were distributing food the same way, no one would be starving.
No one would be starving.
I mean, we haven't run out of the ability to make food. You know what I mean? We can make enough food even with the population our size.
Absolutely.
Our technology has enabled us to make enough food. It is,
we can
bring that people starve is not having anything to do with we don't have enough.
It has nothing to do. And so my charge would be that we start thinking of ourselves as earthlings, and it doesn't matter what we are doing today, we had better hit the pause button and think about life on our planet. We can get back to fighting amongst ourselves later. Once we've solved for some of the existential threats, right? We better be thinking about resilience. And I sincerely believe, Mark, that resilience needs to be our number one investment priority globally. I think we have to stop everything that we're doing and just focus on resilience. And then we have to focus on mitigation.
Because and I think we've gotten really good. I always kind of use this from my brother-in-law is a sociologist who wrote a book and did some research on the idea of this idea of empathy versus compassion. And I thought, you know, in that I use it a lot of times because we have gotten to where we have a lot of empathy. We can go, oh, I feel really bad about that shooting that just happened, or I feel bad about the environment or those people in that community. And so we can say, I feel it.
Low C
means doing something.
Absolutely.
So being compassionate means you have to go beyond feeling it. Mm-hmm. You have to actually, compassion means you actually have to do something about it.
That's right.
Not just, I feel for you. You know,
that's right.
I feel for you is not helpful enough. It doesn't move and it doesn't change systems. And it doesn't mean I have to move to action.
No, that's right. And I love where this is landing because I think that action needs to be informed by compassion and a deep sense of shared humanity.
Okay.
I think that so often we think that because we are, we are in a community that we have shared values and that we have a shared vision. And so what we're asking is that we look beyond those differences, we find the common ground, and that we begin to think about what we need to do as a collective, as a community, to make ourselves stronger and more resilient so that there is a tomorrow. And we can go back to red and blue and pink and green or whatever, you know, we want to identify ourselves with. We can have that conversation later.
Yeah.
Right now, it's about compassion and doing.
And doing,
absolutely. And that's what we're trying to do with the Green Jobs Machine is we're trying to give people a platform that enables them to actually do something.
Yeah, them to do something.
It's right. Yeah, because I think people sometimes... They're there with you, Mark. They've got the compassion. They want to make it happen. And then they're just like, what can I do? I'm just like one human being. And this is just so overwhelming. Well, right. now there's going to be something that you can do. We're going to bring it to your town. You're going to be like, okay, here you go. Do this.
Here we go.
Yeah.
This is great. Just a reminder that Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists and scientists and members of the community to engage in conversations like we're having today. And we encourage you at home to think about the things we've been talking about, to disagree with us and to move forward with ideas that really are solutions to it. And it's conversations that we can have together that make a difference in our world. And we'll be right back.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm having a conversation with Sharon McPherson.
No worries.
About leveraging technology. But more than that, I love this. So our show is about intersections between art and science. And so you may think we've kind of diverted off into sociology or something else, into politics, which we have, but they're important parts of both the idea of creativity, the artistic outputs that we have in a variety of ways, and the science and technology are there. But I love this idea of you employing game theory and the idea as a way of doing that. And something that I think you're working on is the idea that maybe we can do what we've found that people do in gaming, which is they will work for something that's as silly as getting to upgrade their avatar.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, they don't have to have hard cash. Now, we do to solve some of our problems. But what I mean is, if you take it to the city level, and you have some ideas about this. So
yeah,
you take it from there.
Okay. Well, I mentioned four playbooks. And those playbooks are not new playbooks, but how we're tech enabling each of those playbooks is what's new. And in addition to us, and so the just as a reminder, the four playbooks that we're using: community building, incubation, acceleration of those ideas, and then using an AI enabled platform to like match those businesses with the right services, right funders, et cetera. And so I think it's easy to kind of think about like, how do you use machine learning within the context of AI matching, because that's, you know, that's an algorithm that exists. You know, we do that already. But when it comes to community building, how do you leverage advancing technologies in terms of that deep listening? So I mentioned a little bit of in the beginning in terms of like using heat mapping, swarm technology, you know, using things like you know, really biomimicry and mimicking nature, what happens in nature, to say, how do you begin to understand things like swarm creativity and then bring that into the community building element? So when we're not, you know, when we're talking about deep listening and really getting the community super excited and engaged around this whole idea of resilience, we're talking about really seriously tech enabling that process. So how we listen, using, you know, social media tools and deep listening social media tools around that, using behavior tech to say, well, hang on for a second, let's first understand the community dynamics. Who are the real influencers in the community? Who are the people who are really going to drive this? Because every community has a tipping point. You reach that tipping point, you influence the influencers, and then things start to really happen. And that's a real, you know, that's real behavior tech that we're using there. And so this is all happening on a platform where we're aggregating data, we're tagging it, we're translating it, and then we're figuring out what to do based on, you know, those insights. But let's go back to sort of the gaming elements of this. And so we're applying gaming theory on three levels, looking at individuals. So when we talk about the shape the green grand challenges. You know, Mark, one of the things we realized, people love to compete. So like you said, even competing to like, okay, I'm going to get my avatar some cool stuff, or I'm getting some cool furniture in, you know, my second life, you know, house or whatever it is I'm doing, you know, people like to compete. And sometimes they will compete for things that just really don't matter in the real world, right? But people like to compete for things that matter in the real world too, right? So the Green Grand Challenges competition, identifying those innovators and rewarding them giving them celebrity, giving them exposure, giving them resources. But then on the community level, we've got a resilience tiered scoring mechanism that we're building as part of our resilience tech platform. And communities can compete. So we already have two communities in my home state of Virginia. And they're like, okay, well, we're going to be the first. We're going to be number one. We're going to be the most resilient community in our area. And here's our stuff. Communities really love that, right? So then the same thing you're doing on the individual level, doing it on the community level, and then doing it on the city level. And so we've got cities that are like, okay, the most resilient city in America. I like that. I like that for my town. And so we want to do this globally. And so we believe charity starts at home. So we're starting in the United States, but we plan to do this all over the world. And we're finding that by understanding gaming theory, infusing particularly the community building playbook with gaming theory, and then aggregating the data, figuring out what's working, and then making that better as we go, is really a winning formula for us.
I just think that's amazing. That's an amazing use of not only the technology, but the whole idea of being creative in that, you know, that you've been talking also all the way along, and I love this, you know, it's not a new theory, but it's, you're putting it into every part of those four phases you're talking about. And that is the idea that there are assets there. And it, you know, we say a lot about that sometimes when we work with people in communities and stuff, but I think we don't go and look for the assets sometimes. And you said a key word to me that sometimes is misunderstood. And that is the idea about that when you go into a community, you're looking for who the key individuals are, mm-hmm. who are the key leaders, who are those. Typically, we go in and we look at it from a structural social network. So, it's got to be the church pastor, or it's got to be the leader of this, you know, the homeowners association. My experience is that often isn't who the real leaders are. And you're using data through social networking to find who really is the one speaking out about this, right? Mm-hmm. You're changing the model of who is it that leads a community from what we can understand from outside that community. Oh, they must be the leaders. And we misunderstand often they are not the ones that are making the difference. They make a difference. But what I mean is they're not the key people. It might be the one who's talking to their neighbors about everything that's going on in the neighborhood that is the key person.
That's right. And we're taking the guesswork out of it. So yeah. imagine if you could take the guesswork out of like figuring out who are the real influencers in the community.
Huge.
The technology exists for us to do. I mean, for us to use that. It's just not even new technology. I mean, we are definitely creating, you know, new, you know, we call on ourselves, you know, this resilience AI tech, which we were trademarked, by the way. So don't even try. We got our stuff going. But the fact of the matter is that we're taking technology, we're converging, we're merging. I mean, if you take something like, you take robotics, you know, robotics, what is robotics? It's artificial intelligence and things that move, right?
Yeah.
You've converged them and now you've got a robot. Well, that's what a robot is. And so, you know, we're not creating kind of new base technologies. This is all artificial intelligence, you know, machine learning, quantum computing. Once that's available, it's going to be a complete game changer for us. But how do you use social media to deep listen? How do you create a heat map so you know who's communicating about what with what? We've got all of the guardrails also to scrub the data and to make sure that we're protecting people, because we think that that's a big deal. But I just wanted to say a couple of things because I know we're running out of time. We are absolutely creating that AI-enabled map of the community. And what you're talking about now is part of what we've got six categories of data. We've got the social demographics, who's who in the zoo. We've got the critical infrastructure. We've got the scaling infrastructure, of course, things like health, the environment. These are all things that we're going to be aggregating data around. So that 5 years from now, you're not guessing about like what can work. We know that if these are the key attributes of the community and this part of the infrastructure is missing, we got a problem. So we don't need to reinvent the wheel. Bling, the red light goes off. We know that that's where we need to be deploying capital. human, creative, financial, it's going to be invaluable to us as a global society as climate change continues.
Yeah, and you're taking away, which I love in this model, you're taking us away from the anecdotal evidence that we use usually to make decisions.
That's right.
You know, and data can help us in this way. And sometimes people are frightened of that because that takes the control away from them when you actually say, here's the actual information that's happening. I have so enjoyed this conversation, Sharon.
Thank you.
This has been really wonderful. I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again next time when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.